The following Dharma talk was given at Boundless Way Temple in Worcester, Massachusetts. The temple is an affiliate of Boundless Way Zen, a multi-lineage school of Zen Buddhism.
This morning, David and I will be giving the Teisho. And we will be inspired by record of the transmission of illumination, and case one. Shakyamuni Buddha saw the morning star, awakened to the way, and said, I, together with the great earth and sentient beings, simultaneously attain the way. Shakyamuni Buddha belonged to the Vamsa clan in the western lands. At 19 years of age, he leapt over the palace walls at midnight, then cut off his hair on Dandaka Mountain. Thereafter, he practiced austerities for 6 years. Then he sat on the Vajra seat as spiderwebs formed between his eyebrows, a magpie's nest rested atop his head, and reeds sprouted up through his seat. Peacefully abiding, without moving for 6 more years, he sat erect. On the 8th day of the last month of his 13th year, when the morning star emerged, he suddenly awakened to the way, and his very first lion's roar consisted of those words. And the verse. A single twig sprouts from the old plum tree. Thorns and brambles, as time goes by, encroach on it. Rahatsu Sashin, sitting here together, the snow has blanketed the land, and we are here cozy in our zendo, practicing together, reflecting back on Shakyamuni Buddha, and we bow to the statue of Buddha. Every day here at retreat. In some kind of, I think for me, of course, we aren't bowing to some external god or some idol. And yet there is some bowing to the historical Buddha whose enlightenment resounds to this day and inspires us all. This monumental story of his life, such a remarkable inspiration and filled with so many different pointers. And one that's alive for me today is, they're related, two real points of the story that I find so interesting that I wanted to bring up. First, the wall. The wall that he lived behind for the first 19 years of his life. Of course, a wall that was erected out of compassion. That's how I view it. I know there are other ways of viewing it, like the father wanted to be powerful, and these are valid ways of seeing the story, I think, too. Wanted his son to be king and was in his own way kind of greedy. Certainly there probably were some of those elements involved. But another way of seeing it is that this father was in love with his child and was trying to keep him safe and protected from the suffering in the world. He didn't want his son to suffer. And so he built a wall. He built a wall around him and his family. And he tried to keep the bad things out. Of course, there's no wall that's ever going to keep out old age. There's no wall that can ever keep out sickness or death. We eventually lose the people we love. So it was inevitable that one day Shakyamuni would see through the wall in some way and realize that life includes suffering. And it touched his heart, and it touched his heart to see so many people out in the world suffering in ways that he hadn't known and hadn't imagined. And here he'd been living this protected, sheltered existence. And of course, we all do this, don't we? We all build up the walls. We erect the walls to try to protect ourselves from suffering. This is natural. This is human. I don't want to suffer. Perhaps we all have different ways of doing it. We learn through cause and effect eventually that there are certain things we can do to get what we want and avoid things we don't want, and we start working with those things from a very young age. I want some milk. Wah! Oh, yeah, it worked. So we're conditioned from a young age, right, to seek what we want and, of course, to avoid the things we don't like. We don't keep sticking our hand in the hot stove once it's done once. These are all good things. We look at this, this is good. This is why we are alive. Through this conditioning. But as Melissa was talking about yesterday, out of this there comes, a kind of natural evolution into a theory of an actor that is me. And this notion can begin to reify and harden into a sense of self. And it's that sense of self that we build walls around. We try to divide ourselves from the things that we don't want to be me. I don't want death to be me. So we build walls around the graveyards and hide them. I don't want that other political party to be me. So we defriend a whole bunch of folks on Facebook. We gain distance. We create walls between nations, between properties. And the most fundamental wall that we build is the wall between self and other. A notion of a mind that is mine. And you have a mind that is yours. And we imagine that we live and die alone inside these little bubbles. My thought bubbles versus your thought bubbles. Don't get your Republican thoughts mixed up in my thought bubbles there, mister. Hey, I don't want any of your Democratic thought bubbles. So this way we try to protect ourselves, we also do it psychologically, don't we? Pushing away the things we don't like. And as I've said, I think there's something healthy and good about this. There's something right in taking care of ourselves and in taking care of the people we love. But I think we take our walls a little too seriously. We think they're a little bit more real than they actually are. And they cause a great deal of suffering as we do everything we can to maintain them when they are actually quite permeable. And maybe it's fear that causes us to try to keep building up the wall, get some distance between you and me, because it's vulnerable living according to our true nature, which is boundless. Buddha sat under the Bodhi tree and confronted Mara, the demon of his own mind, who presented him with temptations and desires to lure him away from himself, to try to get Buddha to build more walls again, to try to get Buddha to doubt himself. Mara asked, "What makes you think you're worthy of this?" Buddha's reaction was simply to continue to see what was happening. "I see you, Mara. Don't even push Mara away. That's just another wall, another boundary." He let Mara in. "I see you. I see you." And touched the earth. "The earth is my witness." A very brave act to look into the very walls. The wall creator himself, Mara, is part of his own mind. Delusion. "I am a separate fixed entity. I am a self." And one of the great insights he had in that evening through his looking was that this self did not exist in the way that he had imagined. It did not actually exist as a fixed entity. That the stories that he told about himself and others were just stories. That the threats that he felt, arrows fired at him from Mara, when examined, turned into flower petals. That's a really important moment in the story. This transformation that allows for the walls to fall away and for us to open wide. And in that falling away of the walls that separate self from other, all beings together realize the way. I just want to offer a brief caution before I pass the mic. I think we can imagine then that no more arrows come. And I don't think that's true. I think the arrows keep coming. It's a lifelong practice, turning toward whatever is and seeing it clearly, recognizing it.
So seeing deeply, looking deeply into this matter, Zen is a tradition of stories. Our koan stories are root stories, and we human beings are story-making creatures. Mike was talking so beautifully about one of the versions of this story of Buddha's awakening that's found in the Theravadin Sutras, is of Buddha sitting under the Bo tree. By the way, we have our very own Bo tree. It's in the green pot by the window near the altar. So in a sense, we're all sitting under the Bo tree here. And on the altar, one leaf of the Bo tree, one of our Sangha members traveled over. There is a tree somewhere that's supposedly a graft of the tree that the Buddha sat under. And she brought a leaf back for us. So this Bo tree, of course, is the whole universe. And every time we sit here at Sesshin, at your own home, wherever you are, we sit under the Bo tree, this tree of life that we are not separate from. We are this tree. We embody it. Every cell in our body embodies the great vast stretches of time and space that are present here. The very structure of the cell contains universes, all here. And so in this story of the Buddha, Buddha sitting the night before his great awakening. And many of us are waiting for our great awakening. When I first began Zen, my true intention, you might say my secret practice, maybe not so secret, is I wanted to have a great big awakening. I had had some in my life, and I'd read about others, and I wanted that. I did not want what I had. And so I worked very hard, sat up late at night on Sesshin, went to Sesshin after Sesshin. And I kept hoping. I kept hoping that I would be somebody else. And as you see, just failure. I still am no one else. But the Buddha sitting under the Bo tree in this story Mike related spent the night not in tranquil meditation. Just before the big awakening, that is still here, still going on, still is me, still is you. We are Buddha. We have already tasted this. But Buddha did not sit serenely in deep peacefulness. He confronted his demons. His demons confronted him. If you have noticed a demon or two on this retreat, you are in good company. You and the Buddha sitting still. And this great seeing into the true nature. Things arise and we make stories, and often our stories are about separation and lack. Stories about why is it always this way. Stories about what you think you have and what you think you don't have. And many of us make enlightenment into a great obstacle on our path. We fantasize about what this might be. And in some ways, not a problem. But Dogen at several places talks about whatever you think about enlightenment is not enlightenment. It's merely another idea. And yet we celebrate the awakening of the Buddha. And in this story told in this collection by Keizan, And Kazan was a third generation descendant, I believe, of Dogen, and in some ways is the founder of the Soto school in Japan. So, and this text that he wrote in the 13th century actually was not very significant until the 19th century, when it was rediscovered, and currently in the modern Soto world, Kazan is very much revered, and we can get a taste of his genius and his great heart as we read these stories and his verses. And in this telling of the story, because we are always retelling these stories, we sometimes say that Zen is a teaching outside of words and letters, but yet we blab on and on, right? In this version of Kazan's record of the transmission of illumination, not only do we have Kazan's words, but we have probably two or three pages for each word Kazan writes. So we Zen people have been busy with our words, trying to point to this morning star that the Buddha saw so many years ago. And Kazan, as he tells the story, does not focus on the struggle. And of course there is struggle. And of course we must call ourselves forth to meet our life, to sit straight in the middle of. Kazan emphasizes the stillness. Our four great retreat guidelines, silence, stillness, not looking around, not looking away, and doing your best. But this stillness that we emphasize in the Zen way, this stillness as a technique, this stillness as manifestation of life. He said, the Buddha sat on the Vajra seat as spider webs formed between his eyebrows. A magpie's nest rested atop his head, and reeds sprouted up through his seat, peacefully abiding without moving. Peacefully abiding without moving. Such vivid images of this invitation to stillness, and this great practice of peacefully abiding. Sometimes we call this shamatha, abiding right here. And when we hear peacefully abiding, we may think that this has to do with the content of our mind. Like, man, yeah, I'd peacefully abide if I could. It's just I've got all this crap going on inside me. Right? Once I clean that out, then I'll really peacefully abide. I'm all for that. That crap, thing that is most wrong with you, that too, and maybe that especially, is the Buddha, is life itself. And if you try to exclude it, you are excluding yourself. This invitation to peacefully abide is an invitation that we can say yes to at any moment. Each one of us as human beings has this capacity to say yes to whatever is here. And this peacefully abiding is simply being with what is already present. So we can peacefully abide in the midst of great difficulty. We can be in a place in one of the hell realms that Alan so beautifully described. Thank you, Alan, for describing all these hell realms. But we all know them, and so good to include these hell realms and the animal realms and the fighting demons. All of these realms are the Buddha realm. And this invitation to be where you are. So when your heart is broken and you have no hope, can you sit still in the middle of broken, hopeless brokenheartedness? And when the old story comes up about you, whatever that old story is, can you sit still, not moving forward, not moving back, not trying to fix, and not trying to understand? In one of these commentaries, it says, the Buddha was not trying to become enlightened. If we try to become enlightened, we have to have some idea of what enlightenment is, and then we're lost in trying to create a world that's different than this precious world that we already live in. And this invitation to stillness. And then the mind simply does what the mind does. The emotions come and go. One of the wonderful things about retreat is there come to be fewer and fewer excuses. Usually we can blame someone else for our trouble. Our boss, our friends, our family. And here on retreat, we begin to see that it all comes and goes. And complaining mind arises. And when complaining mind arises, wherever it looks, the great universe generously reflects back complaint. So everywhere we can find something to complain about. Ourself, other people, but we see this as it comes and goes, and only when we slow down enough, only when we make this great courageous commitment to do nothing, can we begin to see into this true nature. So this practice of stillness, this practice of calm abiding, is not different from the great cultivation of energy and seeing in and giving ourselves wholeheartedly. We are required, or we are actually invited to give ourselves wholeheartedly. All of us are spending our life. All of us are growing younger to our death. And what are you spending your life on? So to spend your life, to give your life to this moment, to receive what is here, to receive without trying to sort, without needing to sort. Then confusion and despair are fine. And arising panic, and I must leave, I cannot take another moment. We can be present to this moment. resting in our panic, resting in our hopelessness, resting in our ease, resting in whatever is here. So both this calm abiding and this looking deeply are two aspects of our practice. Shakyamuni Buddha saw the morning star, awakened to the way, and said, "I, together with the great earth and sentient beings, simultaneously attain the way." Thank you. So please sit comfortably and turn this way if you'd like. So comments, questions, observations, and I'm going to ask Mike and Bob to help call on people. Pierce.
David and Mike, thank you so much for this talk, which really speaks very powerfully to my own aversion to suffering. You know, I think, like many people, I hoped for self-improvement when I came to Zen. And I might say that, you know, oh, I've seen through that. But I think that realization is kind of, you know, just temporary. It's like, for the time being, I see that I ought not to accept or expect self-improvement. But there's something very habitual that's very deep, that is below words, that is doing this thing on a sort of ongoing basis. And in regard to, you know, one of our watchwords, turning toward, you know, I found myself saying to somebody recently, that's really a very helpful thing for me. And when I said the word helpful, I realized that, as Mike was saying yesterday, I was making it into a project, you know, that here is a tool, like a shovel, and I'm going to dig with it, and there's me and the shovel, and the goal, which is a hole. And so I've noticed that in times of crisis that I really don't turn toward. At least, I'm investigating this. I'm not quite sure what happens. It seems to me like I'm capable of meeting a challenge, but I am on automatic pilot in some sense. And I heard in Mike's show that the fundamental issue here, which ought to be no surprise to us, is the illusion we have that there's something called a self. There's something called me that I have to defend. And so I've got my dukes up already. And I heard in David's talk that it's possible to sit still, to peacefully abide. I love it. Peacefully abide in spite of the fact that I'm neither peaceful nor abiding.
Exactly.
And, so I won't say that those things were helpful. Let's see how they contribute to my ongoing investigations. I won't say they were helpful, but I wouldn't mind if either of you wanted to repeat them.
I think some things are helpful. You know, that I think as we practice, we can begin to know ourselves in some way. And I love how you point to the endless quality of this. You know, when we see through, the experience is, I've seen through. You know, I'm cool. And Mike and I were talking this morning about the infinite creativity of delusion. Mm-hmm. Right? Really infinite. Whatever you see through, it will sneak around the corner, you know, wearing a different outfit, and will be upon you before you know it, and take a while. Oh, And so the good news is that it's we get to wake up over and over and over. Mm-hmm. No end to that.
The of course, infinitely disguised delusion that comes up for me is that there's a me in here and that there's a world out there. And that the world is of a particular quality and that I am of a particular quality, sometimes in opposition to each other. And sometimes aligned with each other, but nonetheless. And it's, you know, you have that day, you're sitting on the cushion and you watch the mind manifest in this way, and then you see that the mind is manifested in this way. That's the moment, right? That's, oh, look what's happened. There's nothing more that's necessary. That's it. That's the whole deal, right there. But what's funny is that, you know, as you say, you see it, and then the joke I made was, you know, you turn your back and before you know it, there I am, back in the kitchen, you know, with this new version of myself, you know, all at work, and then we're looking again. So it's almost, yeah, like you said, almost unconscious the way it sneaks in, right? And then we notice, oh, look what's happened, and we just, you know, keep catching it. And I think part of what's fun about it is that even though it's some of these things can be troublesome and bothersome and painful, it is kind of funny that this keeps happening.
Steve?
Yeah, I sort of what arose for me here is not so much that there's a self, okay, because we're always creating the self. Mm-hmm. It's always there. Mm-hmm. I think for me, it's the hardness of the shell, okay? So how hard is that concept of self, okay? And I think practice pokes holes in those, in that hard shell. Mm-hmm. So in the same way that, like, the bird, okay, you know, a baby bird, it has to breathe, all right? So there has to be a porosity to that shell. There has to be some way for the oxygen to get in, because otherwise it wouldn't live. And I think that in some respects, a lot of what we do is keep, you know, maybe just becoming more aware of those holes, you know, and allowing this exchange that goes on to just happen. So, you know, it's just, I realize it's just another metaphor, another view, but it, you know, for me, you know, it helps. Mm-hmm. Like upaya. What is the skillful me?
Yeah. Thank you. You know, we can go to the extreme that there's no self, and that's another too strong statement, I think. You know, there's, for me, it's helpful to think of, like, there's a sense of self, and it's shape shifting all the time and very fluid. I imagine that it's a thing. That's the hardness. I imagine that it's a fixed, solid thing. But my experience when I look at it is that it's not, is that it's very fluid and shape-shifting and dependent on circumstances, and that's maybe the porousness that you're talking about. It's always kind of mutually conditioned and penetrated, and so, noticing that, I think, is actually a great relief. It's when I believe that the self is a solid, fixed thing, and that it sucks, or that it's better than others, or whatever it may be, or that it needs to be protected, et cetera, et cetera. When I really buy into that, that's when I seem to suffer. But a sense of self is actually very useful, isn't it? Like, we need a sense of self to operate in the world, to, you know, this whole idea of relative truth, I think, is useful for me. There's me and there's you, and we're separate. So it's like different ways of looking at our lives.
I want to hearken back to the delusion of helpfulness, right, for just a minute, because we can be left with the idea, well, this is just of no use at all, right? And I don't believe that. My experience tells me something else, which is that what I come here for is not what I get. Mm-hmm. What I reach for, what I think I need to have, is not what actually turns out to be helpful. So that if anything, it's a bait and switch all the time. Like, oh, that wasn't it at all. But that so that the helpfulness almost is like a side effect of this practice, an effect that I'm not looking at, I'm not aiming for, I'm not expecting. And I just want to put that out there because I think that that we're all here and they've been here for centuries because something happens, because it is helpful. And you all taste it and you all know it. It's just never what we think it's going to be.
Yeah. Thanks.
Yeah.
A story with Ray. Hope Ray doesn't mind. too bad, Ray. In my when I first came to Sesshin, I was in charge of the portable toilets. And the night of when we first get all the work assignments, Ray was showing me how to do it. And somebody didn't know how to use the valve to flush. Which is, everyone, you should use the valve to flush. Because then we opened the toilet and then there was urine everywhere, all over the floor, and it was really bad. And then Ray did this, so I'll pretend we were even. Just laughed. And I thought that was a very cool teaching. And he just didn't take it seriously, and then cleaning it up, I didn't take it seriously, and it was just, yeah. So, I thought that was... Thank you. Yeah. You know, you can imagine Ray laughing like this.
And there is a waiting list to get that particular job. High-class job. But yeah, it speaks to the freedom that's possible. So when the mess comes out and there's urine all over the floor, there's no possibility of some other world. You know, we're in that world. But yet how we meet it, I think, is what we're practicing here. Right? Because it's pretty messy for all of us in our minds just sitting here, let alone, you know, spilling on the floor. But all of us encountering those places and this possibility that we don't have to react in the usual way. It doesn't have to mean, oh, you know, it can be, all right, now this. Yeah, great, thanks. Yeah, good.
I keep kind of circling around, I guess, to me it's sort of commented on how there's so much writing, there's so much words, and we do all of this work trying to get it right and trying to explain it. And a lot of my work, a lot of what I'm working in is kind of this meta-abstraction layer where you're trying to describe everything so that other people can use it and find it and put it together and make meaning out of it. But a lot of the goal is to usually try to come up with a system so that you don't have to try to pre-prescribe a meaning because it's going to be different for everybody. And I've had trouble, I think, sometimes trying to divorce the words sometimes from, like, the actual thing, the thing that's there. And when Zeph just said, well, you know, urine went everywhere, I was like, I think I can try to describe how that would be. But it's not going to be the same unless that word I have is me. It's not going to be the same. And it's really about, like, the experiencing it and the being with people and being in the world. And so that made me laugh. But also, I was just like, I don't think I'd laugh. Or I don't think I'd be grossed out. I think probably panic. So I think that, I don't know, just thank you. It's sometimes very hard for me to pull those things apart.
And, you know, we do talk about that the words are pointing at something we can't ever really speak of.
Yeah.
So I love you noticing that, David.
That's so important. You know, we said, like, you know, the great insight was that there isn't actually a self. That's literally just a sentence. I mean, what actually happens when you sit on the cushion is something that's so alive and mysterious. And this is one way that we can talk about it. This fluidity, this whatever you want to use, right? And yet there are so many other ways of describing what happens when we sit on a cushion. And they're all it.
The words are hopeful, but they're not.
Yes. Yet. Right. Yes. Yes.
So you have to sign up for Zeph's job to really know.
Meaningless. Meaningless.
First of all, thank you both for the talks today. Two things. First thing is, the light in here is really beautiful, and I'm really excited that I get to look up, at least for now, and notice it, so that is great. Second thing is, one of the other sort of prequel origin stories that I've heard about the Buddha's enlightenment is that, you know, when he was still in the palace, he didn't necessarily abscond in the night and, you know, didn't tell anyone. This story that I heard, the version is that he went to his father and said, you know, I'm leaving and this is why. And his father, of course, tried to stop him. And ultimately, you know, Siddhartha said, okay, I'll stay if you can answer yes to these three questions. And the questions were basically three of our five remembrances. You know, can you keep me from growing old? Can you keep me from getting sick? Can you keep me from dying? And his father, of course, had to say, you know, no, I can't prevent any of those things for you. I'm really sorry. And, you know, Sarah said, okay, well, then I have to leave. So whether it's, you know, true or not, we don't know, obviously, if it happened or not, but if it did, I hope that, you know, maybe he taught his father a lesson in some way that, you know, no matter what, no matter how much you care for someone, you can't prevent these three things for them. And that makes me think of a friend of mine who recently gave birth to a beautiful baby boy. And that baby boy died 2 days after he was born. So she never got to see that child grow old. And the death and suffering obviously came very quickly. So that makes me think that the people that were who were lucky enough to have in our lives, if for as long as they're there, we sort of have to accept these three things will happen. Or the alternative is that they're just not going to be with us anymore. So it just sort of makes me think that, you know, as difficult as these, you know, three forms of suffering are, we really kind of have no choice but to accept them and try to be grateful for them, because that means that that person is still with us for now.
And then how do we do this on the cushion right here, right? Because I think we are confronting that which we cannot change, which you're speaking so beautifully of. And then I think the work for all of us is to take it from these stories, and then as we sit, how do I meet this world without defense? And the wonderful thing about this practice is that that's what we're doing. We're not even really learning about Buddhism. It's not about these words, and those words are the pointer for you and for me. Can I meet this world right here, right in this moment? Yeah, thank you.
Ernest?
I don't have a problem not knowing what enlightenment is, what nirvana is. Kind of to the point that you were talking about what words actually mean. And from what I've read, the Buddha really did not want to talk about it, or he could not, and so his explanation was what it is not versus what it is. And I'm thinking about explaining what a painting is to a person who was born blind, or what a symphony is to a person that was born deaf. How do you do that? Do you have a capacity to explain, and does the person have a capacity to understand? Yet the painting is there, and the symphony is there, but we don't have the capacity to grasp it. Like, it's been proven that there are other dimensions, you know. It's easier to understand a dimension that lacks one. I love the word, but you know, when you have more than what we have, You just can't understand how it works. So for me, it's part of that unknowable realm. Now my dilemma is that I have to take it on faith. And Buddhism practice is experiential, and the Buddha was encouraging to ask questions, not to believe, but to try and experience. So, well, you help me.
Enlighten.
You're asking, how do you experience what you can't experience? Is that
right? That's a great question.
If I need, you know, it's almost, you know, blind belief, like a religion, that there is God, but I can't see him. Or how do I experience it? And where the belief starts and where is it going? How it's difficult for me to manage. I know it's another story. I have many stories. That's where I.
So I want to say that we're talking about something we can't talk about, and that there is something that we call awakening. There is something, and it's not what you think, but it's right here.
Yeah.
We have these. Well, I have no ideas about enlightenment, but this isn't it. Right?
I also want to add that I think Dogen was amazing because he understood centuries ago that we cannot ever know reality in its fullness. There's no way. And so his example that we read yesterday of the man in the boat who is in the middle of the ocean and he looks around and it looks like the ocean is a circle, right? And yet, of course, it's not. And so he understood. I think he's saying we will never, no, none of us can ever know farther than our eye of practice can see. Right? That is the human condition. And so not knowing is a fundamental premise of Zen, of never assuming we know everything or even most things. So I don't know if that touches on what you're trying to get at, but that's one of the, you know, as opposed to other traditions that really emphasize knowing as the bedrock, we emphasize not knowing.
Sorry, one last little bit about this. I think often of these terms as pointers to how things already are. So when we say there's no self, then we say, oh, well, then I need, you know, like that's a pointer, right? And then we say, well, then, okay, so what I need to do is get rid of myself and then there will be no self. No, there's already no self. Enlightenment, it's already here. Boundlessness, whatever, right? These are just terms that are pointing to things as they are. And, you know, the issue is that sometimes we get caught in beliefs, right, that lead us down painful pathways, and they're just pointing us back to what we already are.
Well, that seems like a good place to end for me. Thank you all.